Welcome once again to another edition of Cool Stuff Ride Home. I'm Marcus Paff, he's Reggie Rizzou. On today's episode, a centuries-old artifact is pulled from a UK river. And Weird Wednesday, including sandboarding, bees on the loose, banned car horns, and a couple of snakes along the way. Plus, on this day in history, we look back at the Boston Tea Party. That's coming up on Cool Stuff. Getting things started today, I'm going to pose a question to you, Reggie. Have you ever heard of magnet fishing?
I'm assuming it involves throwing a magnet in the water and hoping you find things?
That's a pretty good guess. You'd be spot on. Ding, ding. I'd never heard of such a thing, but obviously, like, you could venture a guess upon hearing the term. It's exactly what it sounds like. The aquatic equivalent of metal detecting, really. A strong magnet attached to a rope, lowered into a body of water to attract metallic objects. It all sounds harmless and kind of fun, actually, for that matter, at least in my opinion. But the Smithsonian Institute cautions that it can be dangerous, with reports of live grenades and other explosives having been snagged in the past. Yikes. Can't imagine pulling one of those things.
What are people throwing in the water? Why are you throwing a live grenade in the water?
Well,
why didn't it go off?
I'm going to guess it's an artifact from, you know, a bygone era that for whatever reason didn't go off, but still has the potential to do such a thing. So, anyway, why am I telling you this? Well, a man named Trevor Penny was magnet fishing an English waterway near Oxford when he pulled out what appeared to be a rusty old sword. Upon having it inspected by experts, he learned that's exactly what it was. A Viking sword, to be exact, dating back to the 8th or 9th century, meaning it's probably more than 1,000 years old. Per Isabel Quay in the New York Times, Penny initially assumed the object he'd pulled from the River Cherwell was a scaffolding pole, which wouldn't have been surprising given the array of things he's pulled out in the past, but he soon thereafter reached out to friends and contacts to procure more information on the object. The sword was ultimately identified by an archaeological group that tracks public finds, leading Penny to turn the discovery over to the Oxfordshire Museum, where it's expected to be put on display following restoration. All that leads us to a bit of a history lesson here. The Vikings landed in the British Isles in the 8th century, doing what you'd probably expect Vikings to do. They raided, they plundered, and they traded their way through England and Scotland. In one sense, the Vikings' presence in today's UK didn't last, but in another sense, it did. Per the UK Historical Association, the final Viking invasion of England came in 1066, when the English king, Harold Godwinson, marched north with his army and defeated the Viking forces in a long and bloody battle. The English had repelled the last invasion from Scandinavia, but unfortunately, immediately thereafter, King Harold learned that William of Normandy, aka William the Conqueror, that's never good when you hear a name like that, had landed in Kent, and yet another invading army was accompanying him. With no time to rest, Harold's army marched south to meet the new threat, but the exhausted English army eventually fell, and William was crowned the new King of England. The irony here is that William was of Viking descent. His great-great-great-grandfather Rollo was a Viking who in AD 911 had invaded Normandy in northern France. His people had become French over time, but in one sense, this final successful invasion of England could be chalked up to the Vikings. So much so that the Vikings' genetic legacy in the UK has left the population with up to 6% Viking DNA. That's pretty wild to think about.
And a lot of Rollos. They're delicious.
Oh my,
no?
Oh my, Moving on! Given all that history, it's probably not surprising that numerous Viking artifacts have been found over the years in England. In 2007, detectorists, I'd never heard that term before, so I had to look it up. It's those who use metal detectors, found a hoard of Viking treasure near North Yorkshire that experts called one of the most significant finds in Britain. Another hoard buried during that era was discovered in 2014 in Galloway, Scotland. And in 2019, two men were actually convicted of theft and ordered to pay $1.5 million after they concealed the discovery of an Anglo-Saxon hoard of treasure and sold some of the items. Now back to Trevor Penny's most recent find. Speaking to the New York Times, Edward Caswell, who documents Oxfordshire finds for the Portable Antiquities Scheme run by the British Museum, said the discovery was, quote, one further puzzle piece that can cast light on our shared heritage, end quote. He cautioned that more analysis was still needed, but that experts confirmed the sword fits with others from that era. And per Jane Kershaw, an associate professor of archaeology at the University of Oxford, quote, we do find Viking weapons, including swords, deposited in rivers in England, end quote. She added that while Penny's sword might have been dropped by accident, the weapons were often intentionally thrown in waterways as part of a ritual, Quote, rivers were seen as gateways to other worlds where gods and other creatures or spirits might live, end quote, adding that archaeologists interpreted such rituals as a Viking plea for protection or luck, perhaps going to battle. Final note on all this, perhaps you were like me and wondered how someone could be convicted of theft for not reporting something they found in the wild to authorities, but instead chose to sell it. And I'm not saying it's desirable behavior, but the fact it's a crime made me at least raise an eyebrow and ask the question. Well, the subject of who owns any artifacts found today can be sort of a sticky wicket and can depend on whether the items are classified as quote-unquote treasure, at least in the UK. According to the Treasure Act in Britain, metal objects more than 300 years old when found must be reported to authorities within 2 weeks. Museums have the chance to claim said objects, and finders and landowners may receive a reward after an object is valued and whether or not it's deemed to be a treasure. This is particularly relevant in Penny's case because it's technically illegal to magnet fish in the river in which he found the sword due to safety concerns. That said, the charity that oversees and enforces these laws agreed not to pursue any charges against Penny so long as he turned over any ownership rights to the museum. So there you have it, Reg. I don't know if you're sitting on any antiquities yourself that you might have found in the local waterway, but kind of a cool story out of the UK there with Penny finding something 1,000 years old.
I'm not going with a Viking sword. I'm going with Excalibur, and it was actually given to him by Lady of the Lake. You know, she arranged the sword there so he could have that. That's my theory. All that other stuff, nah. History, nah. I'm going with myth.
Well, there's no follow-up to that one, folks. Reggie has officially lost his mind. I guess we move on to other weird things in Weird Wednesday.
Come on, you're pulling a sword out of the water like it's magical?
I said moving on.
Well, since I already made it weird, let's make it Weird Wednesday. So last week during Weird Wednesday, we talked about skijoring. This week, let's cover sandboarding. The practice is making a comeback in the Namibia Desert in the seaside resort town of Swakopmund. About 1 million tourists would normally visit there, a lot of them coming from a cruise ship. However, that came to a standstill during COVID. It took years for the numbers to climb back up, but now that they are finally about where they used to be, sandboarding is making a comeback there as well. So what is sandboarding?
It's pretty basic. Sounds like a torture tactic.
It kind of does. Well, to me, I think it would be. It's pretty basic. People slide down sand dunes on a board and they either stand up or they lie down while doing it. They can either use like a surfboard looking contraption or a snowboard. They travel down the dunes then going up to 50 miles per hour. That's where the torture would come in. I don't know if I would trust that. I mean, I would think maybe the sand might be a little bit softer if you crash than some stuff, but I don't know if I trust this, Marcus.
50 miles an hour. No, that's moving out. And with no protection? Yeah, it sounds kind of frightening. Yeah.
Aileen Yazan, a media professional from London who is visiting the area for the first time, said, quote, "It's one of the best things to do around here," end quote, which I don't think sounds as good as they think it does if you say that about the rest of the area. Maybe that's me. Devin Waters, who's 28, has lived in the area for years and said it allowed him to escape the possible life of drugs and crime, which are kind of common around that area. Quote, "Sandboarding changed me a lot. It keeps me off the streets because we work here every day. It puts bread on the table," end quote. He's now been a sandboarding guide for 8 years. So, Marcus, are you ready to go grab your snowboard and head out to the dunes and start sliding down them?
I'm not, but, you know, hearing that last bit of the story that you talked about and how it kept Mr. Devin Waters there off the streets, I mean, maybe I'm not giving it enough credit for just how big of a deal it is in their culture. It almost sounds like any other sport to them that they take very seriously, and people throw a lot of their time and energy behind in favor of this over things that maybe not so desirable.
I mean, to be fair, if I wasn't such a scaredy cat, it probably is fun, but I don't want to risk my life doing it.
Well, people do move out when they're snowboarding on snow, so I suppose doing it on sand? I guess I'm going to have to look this up, check out some videos, because, you know, maybe it's more fun than I'm giving it credit for here.
Well, and it does have the advantage of I'd rather be hot than cold, so I'd rather be doing sandboarding, I guess, than snowboarding.
Agreed.
The next Weird Wednesday story, I'm going to start off with a quote. "This was my first bee catastrophe." That coming from Adams County EMA Director Brad Bradford. Great name, by the way, Brad Bradford.
Very nice.
"It all started in Mississippi where an 18-wheeler that was hauling beehives overturned on the highway. That is when Bradford had to call in the specialist. beekeepers to round up thousands of bees. They did swarm around the truck, but it could have been worse. Since it happened at night and bees usually aren't active at that time of the day, and the hives were covered in a tarp, the bees did remain mostly calm throughout the incident. Quote, the majority stayed in the vicinity of the wreck and were able to be contained in or near their hives, end quote. That coming from Brad Bradford. However, it wasn't until 7 a.m. the next day before the scene was cleared. By the way, no injuries were reported from the crash or from the bees. So how does one round up bees, I'm curious? With a net? That seems like picking up thousands of pins that fell on the floor. I mean, it can be done, but it seems like a very tedious project. Like, there's a bee, especially at nighttime, trying to find them all and collect them all.
I just can't imagine even beginning to try to take on that task. I would just assume that you hope for the best, that they want to remain near their home rather than flying off into God knows where. So, yeah, taking a net, I just can't imagine.
I'm sure they got better ways, but... I don't know what. I mean, usually, yeah, they want to be by their queen in some way. So I'm sure that helped. But how do you entice them? It's not like you can hurt them like you can cattle.
No, it's all, I mean, I know nothing of such subject matter, right? Or beekeeping or anything. But I'd assume you'd need some professionals to go in there, suit it up, and just reset all the hives to where
smokers,
they were.
I'm assuming.
When you, how would I know? I don't know. Just reset the hives and wait for them to come home, essentially. I mean, that would be my plan. I don't think there's anything else that you can do to corral a bee to go back to the exact spot that you want it. So, I mean, even if you did trap them somehow, now what? We're putting them all in a jar and then throwing them on the truck too until we get there? It just, I have no idea.
I don't know. I think if I was the truck driver for that, if I knew there were bees in the back of my truck there, I don't know. Maybe I'd drive a little bit safer, I guess. I don't know. I don't want to spill a bunch of bees, get them angry.
Yeah. Did we not get a rationale for how this thing veered off course, off the road?
No, there was no report on why or how it crashed. They said it did crash.
Yeah, then that's totally fair point. One, I can't imagine you're going through slippery conditions somewhere. If you're in an area that's icy, that's going to kill the bees, unless it was climate controlled.
Yeah, this was Mississippi, so you'd think they would have been fine.
So you would assume, to your point, maybe need to drive a little safer and keep that baby on the road. I don't know.
And all I can imagine is Tommy Boy, bees, bees everywhere, running away. That's all I have in my head right now.
Save yourselves.
Heading off to Cambodia, children dancing in the streets will probably be coming to a stop. Cambodia Prime Minister has ordered a ban on musical horns for vehicles after people posted videos of them dancing in the streets as trucks passing honked their horns. Hun Minh, who took over the government from his father, who was in charge for 38 years, wanted the Ministry of Public Works and Transportation and the police to put a stop to this. So any car that replaced a horn by one that plays a tune instead will have that horn ripped out and replaced with a normal one. Action has already been taken, but he announced it officially to ensure that it would be a nationwide ban.
Okay, so people in Cambodia are actually ripping out their traditional horns and putting in something that plays a song of some sort.
Correct. You know, like you hear sometimes, you hear like the trucks that play the Dixie tune or whatever when they honk their
horn. Well, that's
like
eight notes. This is sounding like people are legitimately dancing in the streets. Ain't nobody out there dancing to. I mean, that's over in half a second. There's got to be more to it than that.
I don't know. I'm kind of curious right now what ice cream trucks are going to do. Do they get to play their music? I don't know. It sounds dangerous.
Do we have ice cream trucks in Cambodia? I don't know.
I don't know, I guess. So on social media, he said that this is being implemented because of the, quote, inappropriate activity committed by some people, especially youth and children, dancing on the roadside to the musical sounds from truck horns, end quote. He believes the dancing affects public order and poses a traffic hazard that could harm drivers or those dancing.
Well, without knowing all the details, I would say that he's probably correct. If there are people actually dancing street side or even in some cases even in the street when I was reading this story, yeah, that's kind of a public safety concern.
But on the other side, can't people have fun? I mean, well, you want public safety, yeah. But couldn't you say implementing a law to remove any type of non-traditional car horn does seem to be a little extreme?
It does, but again, if kids are jumping into this, I think of these social media trends, these lunatic social media trends that take off where kids are doing stuff that's just not good for them, but you're young, you're dumb, you don't think about it. And in this case, again, if you're standing along a narrow street and cars are flying by 55, 60 miles per hour and you're just dancing, I mean, I can sort of understand where cars going by are saying, what's happening here? Can we keep the kids off the street? Because I don't want to be liable when one of them gets nicked or worse yet is hit by me, and severely injured or even killed because of this. So, I mean, I feel like we need a little more context, but based on how I'm reading this, I get wanting to nip it in the bud.
Staying in the car, there are mother bleeping snakes in the mother bleeping car. Or at least that's what I'm sure was said when police arrived on the scene.
Did you just say that?
Yeah, I did. Hey, I kept it clean, right?
you sure did.
Well, one driver in Spain called police when she discovered a snake inside of her car while driving on the highway. The special services police arrived on the scene and quickly called in the environmental police station for backup. I did not know those two police forces existed in Spain, but now I do.
Nor did I.
It turns out the snake was a Northern American corn snake, which is non-venomous and sometimes kept as pets. They are still trying to identify the owner, but all I know is I would not have been a fan if a snake randomly started slithering around my car as I was driving on the highway.
No, because you have no idea. I mean, unless you're a snake expert, you're not able to identify that thing in the moment and know whether or not it's poisonous. I mean, I think you have to assume the worst anytime something like that happens. So, yeah, that would creep the heck out of me, too.
I've seen people freak out because they saw a spider in their car. Imagine seeing a snake.
Yeah,
that would be bad.
I know. Unexpectedly like that while moving at high speed. While playing your horn that plays a song.
And here's another snake story. I would not be...
just glossing over that one, aren't we?
I'm just glossing over that one. Yep. I wouldn't be a fan of this situation either. As we close out Weird Wednesday, here's one more about a snake. After about 1 month on the loose in the city of Lelystad in the Netherlands, a venomous snake that escaped its owner's home has finally been captured. A month on the loose. The shield-nosed cobra was found as it was relaxing in a doorframe down the street from its owner's home. City officials said, quote, city surveillance and the police were on site within minutes and kept the area safe and quiet. The owner was also on site within a few minutes and immediately caught the snake and stored it safely, end quote. So besides being a little weakened by the cold, the snake was in good health and will be moved to a new home at a specialist snake center outside of the city. If I was that person's neighbor, though, I don't think I'd be too happy to know that their venomous snake was on the loose, especially if I was a person that came home and found that snake just kind of sitting in my doorway.
Oh, you're not kidding. I do wonder, and the story doesn't talk about this, but I'm assuming you can have charges brought against you in such a situation where you own and retain a venomous pet that gets out. I mean, at least I don't know what the laws in the Netherlands look like, but here I would assume in the U.S. you'd be liable for such a thing if anything bad were to happen.
We do have rules on what you can and can't own. And I don't know if an individual can own a venomous snake or if that, you know, has to be done with a professional. I'm glad to see it's going, at least it should be somewhere safe now, going to a specialist snake center.
Well, in most cases, and again, I don't know the first thing about this either, but it feels like you hear of these types of exotic animals being owned through a special permit of some kind. So you have to go in and prove that you're capable of taking care of such an animal and certainly keeping the public safe in the process. Yeah. But nevertheless, even if you did all that and the snake still got out in this case, I'm assuming, you know, whatever damage it does is on the person who retained that animal. You know what? I'll talk to a lawyer and get back to you next week.
Heading off to this day in history, I may be stretching it a little bit, but this day in history actually started on December 16th, 1773. With the political protest of the Boston Tea Party. I think we're all mostly familiar with that. After Britain was deep in debt, it imposed a bunch of taxes on American colonists to help them pay it off. Naturally, it didn't sit well. In 1770, the Boston Massacre occurred, leaving 5 colonists dead and 6 injured. Eventually, Britain repealed all the taxes, except the tea tax, which nearly 1.2 million pounds of tea were consumed by colonists every year. So in protest, The colonists smuggled in Dutch tea, leaving a huge surplus for the British East India Company, which made them face bankruptcy. In May of 1773, the Tea Act was passed to make tea cheaper, but still the smuggling of tea continued because people didn't want to pay those taxes. The Sons of Liberty, which include John Adams, Benedict Arnold, and Paul Revere, organized a rally on December 16, 1773 to protest the tea tax, and a large group of colonists voted to refuse to pay them. The governor refused to have the ship unloaded until the tax was paid, so that night, that's when the Boston Tea Party occurred. Now, following that, this is where I get to the this day in history. On March 7th, King George III charged colonists in Boston with attempting to injure British commerce. But it was on this day in history, March 20th, 1774, the British Parliament passes the first of the Intolerable Acts, the Boston Port Act, which closed the Boston Harbor until colonists would pay for those damages following the Tea Party. Now, following that act, the British government ordered the port of Boston closed to punish the colonists for the Tea Party. And it wasn't until, this is part of the reason why I wanted to bring this up, September 30th, 1961, that a bill for the Boston Tea Party was paid by Mayor Snyder of Oregon, who wrote a check for $1.96 to pay off. Now, that was only to pay off their community's portion of the tea loss. Davison and Newman, who accepted the check, they're a London tea firm, said, quote, "We are very grateful to the people of Jackson County. Now we are waiting to hear from the rest of Oregon's counties and the other 49 states," end quote. Overall, the Boston Tea Party debt, it was $4,966. So I guess we got a ways to go before that port can officially open. I don't know.
Well, all right, a few things. Why are you waiting to hear from 49 other states? Most of those states did not exist. I mean, your home state, my home state of Wisconsin, I don't think we're pitching in on the Boston Tea Party debt. There had nothing to do with it. But also, Benedict Arnold, there's a name you don't hear in many other contexts aside from that of traitor. So kind of wild to hear him thrown in there with the Sons of Liberty. And then finally, I guess my question in all of this is, are the ingredients, do they not exist within the northeastern portion of the U.S. to make our own tea, even though at that time the U.S. was not its own independent nation yet? You would assume that they could manufacture some of it here, right? I mean, clearly we do today.
I don't know how to answer that. I guess it was better tea coming from England or coming from the Dutch. I don't know. That's a good question.
We know tea is a way of life, certainly in the UK. It's a big deal there. The other thing that came to my mind is, maybe this is when the U.S. switched to their affinity for coffee instead of tea.
Maybe. I do think it would be a good publicity stunt for some company to be like, we're just going to pay off the rest of this debt. Maybe like some type of a Boston tea company to pay off the rest of the debt. That'd be a good national story and get some attention going to your company. That's what I think.
Yeah, it would. You're not wrong about that. And it's not like that bill is insanely high by today's standards. I mean, nearly $5,000, but
that's still, what I mean. For $5,000, if you can get national publicity from this, that's well worth it.
Yeah, you're not lying. You and I know darn well what ad agencies spend on on global campaigns, and that's a lot more than $5,000.
That'll close out another edition of Cool Stuff Ride Home. You can reach us at coolstuffcommute@gmail.com. If you have any corrections or thoughts, feel free to email us. Also, like us and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. I'm Reggie Rizzou. He's Marcus Path. We'll be back with more cool stuff tomorrow.